to The Wildlife Explorer, a podcast by Essex Wildlife Trust, where we aim to inspire you with our work to protect the wildlife and wild places of Essex, and what you can do to help wildlife wherever you live. On today's show, we're going to be talking about some of the wonderful species and places that are special to Essex. Did you know Tiptree Heath Nature Reserve is the only place in Essex where you'll find all three heather species growing together? And it's the largest area of lowland heathland in the county. We'll be finding out more about this heather haven, as well as delving into why our native oyster population are unsung heroes in our waters. We'll also be taking a tour around the spectacular Edwardian Gardens of Worley Place, once home to famed horticulturalist Ellen Wilmot. It's all coming up on the show. If you live outside of Essex, you may already have an opinion on what you think life here is like. Famously known in some circles as being a magnet for fake tan and questionable footwear, beauty salons and a fair bit of drama. Once, when I was on holiday in Egypt, a local there even asked me where my white stilettos were, so it's fair to say that for a small place in a small country, Essex is firmly on the map across the world, just not always for the best reasons. However, Essex is actually a gloriously meandering place. Yes, it's flat, there's not much we can do about that, but it's also home to idyllic, unspoilt countryside, picturesque villages such as Dedham and Finchingfield, to name but two, wide open fields, salt marshes, trickling rivers, towering cliffs at the Naze, and 350 miles of coastline. We here count ourselves lucky to be here, and if you choose to come and visit, you might be pleasantly surprised by what you find. Today, we wanted to highlight some of the things that are special to Essex, and we will start by taking a stroll through the fabulous gardens of Worley Place, a nature reserve once home to renowned horticulturalist Ellen Wilmot. Although little remains of the house that once stood there, the gardens and their accompanying story are loved by visitors from far and wide. Snowdrops carpet the reserve early in the year, followed by an explosion of daffodils and then bluebells. Many species of bird call this reserve home, as well as meadow and woodland butterflies and a diverse range of invertebrates. Mick Hedges, volunteer warden at Worley Place and font of all knowledge when it comes to the rich history here, is here to take us on a mini tour.
Hi, my name is Mick Hedges. I am the volunteer warden at Worley Place. I'm just going to give you a short tour of Worley Place, and it will be short. To do a full circuit around Worley Place probably takes an hour and a half or something like that. So what I'm going to do is just give you a little walk around the reserve, short route, a circular route, and just pick up some of the highlights. Started out from the car park where all visitors do arrive, and you immediately see on your right a fenced off meadow. It's good to see this year we've got some cattle in, first time in over 2 years, so we've got 23 cattle. The idea is to keep all the grass down, get it quite short. It's been undergrazed in the past, so additional cattle should get the grass down quite nicely, allowing new species to come through. As opposed to being overcrowded by tusky grass. And on the left here, we've got a pond. We refer locally quite simply as South Pond. It's quite an old pond. It was certainly one of the main watering holes for stock for the village of Great Worley. And it sits beside the main drive, what we refer to the main drive, up to the old house that used to be here. Before 1866, this main drive was the main road into Brentwood from Great Worley. And you can see, again, on the right-hand side, walking up the main drive, some very large old trees. These formed the main Avenue for the road into Brentwood. On the right hand side, going into the wooded area now, you'll see in the springtime it's covered in initially snowdrops, then daffodils, bluebells, then later on we get a big host of foxgloves, which is great. And on the left now, I've got a very unusual plant. This is called pokeweed. We're not sure how it got into Worley Place, and it does crop up in various places. It originates from Florida in the USA, so yeah, we're not sure how it got here. One of many unusual plants that are at Worley Place, and some of these were a legacy from Ellen Wilmot. Ellen Wilmot was a very highly regarded Victorian Edwardian horticulturalist. She lived here from the 1870s, moved here with her family, mum, dad, sister Rose, and mum and dad died in the 1890s, her sister married into money, so she was left here to fulfil her passion of gardening. And as we go around the reserve, we do pick up quite a few of those relics from Ellen Wilmot's time. Some very, very unusual plants, some of them now quite rare. Again, on my left, getting towards the top of what we refer to as the top of the drive, to where the whole house was, there's a barren area, small barren area on the left, and we do get lots of violets there in the springtime as well. On my right now, it's opening up, and you'll see here there's a ha-ha. You have to realise what a ha-ha is. It's an invisible barrier between the main drive as we're walking along, and the meadow, and also the house that was there as well. But it's an unobstructed barrier as well. In the meadow on the right-hand side is a very old walnut tree. We've got photographs that Ellen Wilmot took in her day, probably 1890s, 1900s, of her sister. And potentially somebody else. We don't think it is Ellen Wilmot, because she probably took the photograph, but certainly a sister and another sitting under that tree. And we're talking about the end of the 19th century. In front of me now, I've got the old turning circle. The turning circle was in front of the house, and there is a picture here of the house as well now. Give you some idea of the grandeur of the house. It was pulled down, we think, by a property developer who bought the land after Ellen Wilmot died in 1934. The story goes that the house is in a very poor state, and the property developer wanted to develop this land into luxury villas, and we believe it, and because perhaps there was less laws in preserving such buildings before the Second World War, he was able to pull it down. Well, he did anyway. Turning left now, you can see some old gate shrouds where there used to be a gate, and in front of that there's a bit of a description of the gates. And immediately to the right of those old gates is a very unusual tree called a headache tree. This tree is the only one of its genus, and it comes from California, probably put in by Ellen Wilmot. And the reason why it's called a headache tree is, the story goes, is that if you get the leaves and rub them together and take a big sniff, it'll give you a headache. There is a story about if you put it in hot water and infuse it and drink it, it gets rid of the headache, but I'm not going to try that. Now, moving on a bit further on, we've got on the right here what remains of the old cellars where the house used to be. It's overgrown at the moment, but lots of good spread of rose bay willow herb in there, attractive for invertebrates, etc. And on the left now, moving on, we've got a fairly open area. In Ellen Wilmot's time, this was a lawned area, and it was called the Pleasance. The Pleasance, since Ellen Wilmot died, has become, I wouldn't say overgrown, we do try to keep it clear, but there's quite a few trees that have grown since the 1930s, and there's certainly no grass to be had there today. As you go around Worley Place, you have to try and imagine it without a lot of the trees that are now here. And on the right is what's left of an old conservatory, which was actually attached to the house. We had a structural, I wouldn't say a survey, but a structural review done of all the brickwork at Whalley Place, and it was determined that some bits are starting to fall off the conservatory. So at the moment we've got that cordoned off for visitors. You used to be able to sit in there. The good news is that the Wildlife Trust has actually managed to find some money to get some repairs done and bring it back into order, so it will be accessible for the public. We're hoping to get that done with fingers crossed later in 2022, but if not, certainly in the spring of 2023. On my left now, I can see what used to be, well, what is a rose arbor. We believe there used to be an old rose arbor there in Ellen Wilmot's time. It's got a flint nap floor, and that was the early signs that there was something there, and they determined, the volunteers in the 1970s, that's when the trust actually took Whalley Place on, that there was probably a rose arbor here. The Wildlife Trust took, as I mentioned, took on Whalley Place in the 1970s. It was the developer who bought the land in the 1930s before the Second World War, and it was his grandson who took responsibility of Whalley Place, and he decided that he wanted it managed in the proper way, certainly for wildlife, and to maintain historic structures as well, as much as possible. The trust got involved, and it's only been really in recent years that we've been managed to get some other funding to start addressing some of the brickworks that are falling apart. In front of me now, I've got some sweet chestnuts. One, two, three, four, five, six, seven sweet chestnuts. Another name locally, they call them Spanish chestnuts, but they're all the same. Ellen Wilmot allegedly used to tell a story to her visitors to her garden that these trees were planted by a 17th century diarist, John Evelyn, who owned this land at the time. But it turns out that only one of these trees is probably old enough to be planted by John Evelyn. But Ellen Wilmot liked to tell a story. I turned left in front of the sweet chestnuts, and a little bit further, just past the last sweet chestnut, there's a gap. And you can see right across to Canary Wharf into London from here, which demonstrates how high up we are at Whalley Place here. A little bit further on, there's a summer house on the left. An old summer house, but looking again across the same view into London, they do say that with a keen eye and a clear day, you can actually see St. Paul's Cathedral. I could just about manage it with a pair of binoculars, so that just shows you that it's not that easy to see. But we're talking about 20 odd miles away. Moving down a bit further along the path, on my right now, I can see what's termed as the West Meadow. This is where the cows were originally put in to Whalley Place. They've really taken all the grass back in this area now, and that's why we've moved them into the East Meadow now. To my left, two spindle trees, which are a legacy of Ellen Wilmot, which is quite a picture in the autumn. And a little bit further along on the left-hand side, there's an ironwood tree, very, very hard wood. And when the branches do cross each other, they do weld together. Another one of Ellen Wilmot's legacy plants. Walking along the path further, we come across a sign, South Pond Hide. That's there on back little route that takes you to a South Pond with a hide overlooking it. We do put bird feeders out for the birds, and we get quite a few birding people sitting in there sometimes. I've now come to a bridge that overspans a gorge area. When Ellen Wilmot was 21, she went to her father and said, "I would like to build myself a gorge." Such was her passion. She wanted to grow alpine plants. She had a gardener she brought over from Switzerland, Jakob Murray, a young lad. He was keen on alpine plants, and she employed him to look after the alpine gorge. The Alpine Gorge was installed by a company up in York who brought all the stones down from Yorkshire, and they laid this gorge out. At one end, on the bridge looking to my left, round the corner, there used to be a small pond, and water used to trickle through the Alpine Gorge over a stone bridge, now where the wooden bridge is, and down to the right into the South Pond. Quite a feat for somebody who's 21. Not that she did it herself, I'm sure, but she oversaw what was going on. This is, as I mentioned, a whistle-stop tour around Worley Place. This has only taken about 8 or 9 minutes, I think, but there's a lot more that we didn't touch on, including the walled garden, where all the cold frames were, the glass houses and the hot houses. Perhaps that's for another day. And thank you for listening.
Thanks, Mick. It is a fascinating place for a day out. So if you'd like to go and visit for yourself, go onto our website and search for Worley Place for more information. We mentioned earlier in the show that we are lucky to have 350 miles of coastline in Essex with different characteristics and wildlife to be found there. One of our native species is the oyster. You may have eaten a few of these at a fancy restaurant, but these little creatures are far more than an expensive starter. Oysters have been around for 200 million years unchanged, and have been cultivated in the creeks around Mersey Island since the Roman times. However, we need to make sure we look after them, as they are eco-engineers in their own right, cleaning our water and making it habitable for countless other species. Lauren Crossan, our communications officer, is here to tell us a bit more.
This evening, I've come for a walk along the coast. I think there's something so calming about spending time near water. It just looks peaceful. I hope you can hear the waves ebbing and flowing on the shingled beach as I walk. And I'm sure you can hear the wind, so sorry if it's a bit loud. Sometimes I look out across the water that stretches further than I can see. And I think of all the busy animals in life that live just beneath the surface. As I was walking earlier, I came across an oyster shell. Looking at the species, I could tell it's a native oyster because of its flat, rounded shell. I only had one half of the two-part shell, but this half featured ridges and bumps that overlap, sort of like a weird stony fingerprint. And it was a stony colour, splodges of greens and purples made it look a bit like it was bruised from being turfed up by the tide. The native oyster, also known as the flat oyster, loved the sheltered muddy respite of estuaries dotted along our coastline. They've been a part of Essex culture and coastal heritage for such a long time that they're sometimes known as the Colchester oyster. The popularity of native oysters has even dated back to Roman times, so they're definitely an iconic species. Unfortunately, overfishing of this popular food source, as well as invasive species, disease, and pollution, has meant that we've lost 95% of the native oyster population since the 1850s. Aside from the negative impact this can have on the fishing industry, it also means that the valuable service they provide to the underwater world is taken away. You might be thinking, what do I mean, valuable service? You probably can't imagine that this rocky creature does much at all. But looks are deceiving. Native oysters are actually known as ecosystem engineers because they do so much for the marine species around them. Did you know that oysters filter feed? They can filter up to 200 litres per day through their gills, helping to purify the water so more plants can grow underwater, and also preventing algal blooms from harming wildlife. When you have a healthy population of oysters, they could form a whole oyster bed or oyster reef. Within estuaries, mussels, barnacles, and other sea settlers enjoy this new area to live upon. Other members of the ecosystem, like eels, crabs, and fish, enjoy foraging in this feeding hotspot, as well as sheltering here when avoiding prey. Young juveniles especially like the safety of the oysters when exploring the watery world for the first few times. As you can gather, these are really important species and we don't want to lose them. But all hope is not lost for this wonderful creature. Luckily, the southeast boasts the highest remaining population of native oysters, and Essex Wildlife Trust is working in partnership with local fishermen, conservationists and government regulators to conserve this important species through the Essex Native Oyster Restoration Initiative, or better known as ANORI. In 2013, 284 kilometres squared of the Blackwater, Crouch, Roach and Colne estuaries was designated a marine conservation zone, and so began the largest marine restoration project in the UK by area. By working collaboratively, the Trust hopes to recover self-sustaining populations of these culturally, economically, and environmentally valuable native oysters so that the tradition of the Colchester oyster can live on.
Thanks, Lauren. Definitely an underappreciated species that we are lucky to have and be able to look after here in Essex. Now let's see what's happening this month in our wildlife wows, what you can hope to spot while you're out and about. August is the perfect month to spend some time at the coast, exploring rock pools and hunting for fossils. If you're lucky, you might spot common seals with their pups. Despite the name, common seals are in fact less common than grey seals, and amazingly, pups are able to swim from just a few hours old. Oyster catchers, ringed plovers, avocets and lapwings can also be found along the shoreline, hunting for a tasty morsel. Don't forget to check out our website to see what events are happening near you. We often have guided walks where course leaders can help you identify the species living there, education events where children can learn more about our Essex wildlife, as well as building dens, bug hunting, getting muddy and lots more. Now let's see if we can help you to identify some more birdsong this month in our What Three Birds feature. This month we're going to focus on corvids, and first up is the magpie. Big fans of anything shiny, a bit like myself, magpies collect all kinds of objects to decorate their nests. They are one of our most familiar birds and the source of much myth and legend. One for sorrow, two for joy is a rhyme that many children learn. Magpies are in fact small crows and are omnivorous, feeding on carrion, invertebrates, chicks and eggs. They are sociable birds and are often seen chattering noisily in small groups across many habitats, from gardens to parks and heaths to hedges. Next up is the crow. The crow that we are most familiar with is the carrion crow. It's completely black and makes a hoarse cawing sound. Carrion crows make big nests out of twigs, rags, bones and anything else they can find, which they hide in tall bushes. They do not nest in colonies like rooks, but are mostly solitary. Carrion crows are birds of farmland and grassland, but are extremely adaptable and will come to gardens for food, often seeming to be quite fearless. They feed on dead animals, as their name suggests, invertebrates and grain, as well as taking eggs and chicks from other birds' nests. Although now classed as a separate species to the similar hooded crow, the carrion crow can interbreed with its cousin, and hybrids do occur where their ranges cross. And lastly for today, let's hear a jackdaw. Our smallest crow, the jackdaw, is a bird of woodland, parkland, coast and urban areas. It nests in holes in trees and on cliffs and buildings. Sometimes it will even nest in chimneys. It eats invertebrates, fruit, seeds and carrion, and occasionally takes eggs and nestlings. A sociable bird, the jackdaw can be seen in flocks, often performing aerial acrobatics. Jackdaws mate for life, pairing up during their first year, but not mating until the year after. The pair will often sit next to each other, preening themselves. Okay, now let's head over to our popular Tiptree Heath Nature Reserve to join Joan Pinch, who is the warden here and who, along with her team, passionately look after the swathes of purple heather and wildlife to be found there.
Although it's not a huge place, being only 24 hectares or 61 acres in size, Tiptree Heath is the largest significant heathland in Essex. It is also lowland heath, which is a rare habitat across the world, even rarer than the rainforest. It's designated as a site of special scientific interest, mainly for being home to three different types of heather. And these are the bell heather, which likes dry conditions, the cross-leaved heath, which prefers wet areas, and the commonling, which doesn't mind how wet or dry it is. At the moment, they're all in flower, giving a pink look to everywhere around the heath. It's unusual to see all three growing side by side, and we think this is due to the geology of the site. It's situated on the Tiptree Danbury Ridge, which is mainly well-draining, sandy, gravelly soil, but also in places the underlying London clay is near to the surface, and that creates some damp patches after rainfall. Heathland is host to a range of dependent wildlife, including mice, voles and shrews, which in turn attract birds of prey such as buzzards, sparrowhawks and kestrels, and recently we're even seeing a couple of red kites around. Amongst the insect life are some unusual ones. One is the minotaur beetle, a large black dung beetle which picks up rabbit droppings in its front legs, then carries them down holes to feed its larvae, which live in a maze of underground tunnels. Many grasshoppers are jumping around in the hot weather. However, an unusual predator that has a taste for them has recently arrived to set up its vertical web near the ground to catch them when they jump into it. It's the wasp spider, with a large body and legs, all of which are coloured with yellow and black stripes. It's quite a sight to see. Tiptree Heath is what is called a mosaic of habitats, with open areas surrounded by denser scrub and trees, so we get beauty in all different aspects. In April this year, we were delighted also to have seven singing nightingales here, making use of all the habitats. Heathland in general is a man-made habitat, created in the Middle Ages when early people needed to fell trees and cut the bracken and gorse for their domestic use. Nowadays, we try to emulate the methods they used and manage our heath by using hand tools and machines, but our most important and effective tools have four legs. We've grazed Exmoor ponies for some years and at the moment have five lovely mixed-coloured cattle doing the same job of being 24 hours a day munching machines. They also regularly trample undergrowth to keep down the invasive scrub, which threatens to overwhelm the heather and other heathland flowers. All in all, There's a lot to see at Tiptree Heath, and we hope you can visit here sometime soon.
Thanks, Joan. I loved visiting Tiptree Heath when I went and seeing the heather alive with all the bouncing grasshoppers everywhere. It's such a nice place for a wander around when you have some spare time, so do go and visit if you can. Well, that's about all we have time for today, but join us again next month when we'll be having a foodie special here on the podcast, which is one of my favourite things. So I, for one, am very much looking forward to that. In the meantime, take care, keep spreading the word, and we'll see you again in September.